Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, the Sierra Nevada is tinder dry this summer. As officials predict wildfire season will be especially bad, we talk with forestry managers and also locals in the mountain communities to find out why some are warning of potential mega fires this year. We'll also learn why some in the valley are concerned a decision by the Public Utilities Commission could unfairly hurt valley residents when it comes to electricity bills. John Cox from the Bakersfield Californian will join us. We'll also talk with Fresno photographer Howard Watkins about his new photo exhibit documenting decades of his work, and Delray farmer Nikiko Masumoto, whose family is the subject of a new documentary that is screening this weekend at their family farm. We'll have those stories coming up later this hour. Agriculture consumes a lot of water in California, but so do homes and businesses. In the fourth year of the drought, water consumed by both are issues, and both sectors have faced cutbacks. But as Valley Public Radio's Ezra David Romero reports, the Central Valley town of Reedley is on the move to build an eco-friendly community that some say could use less groundwater for development and living.
In the valley town of Reedley, there's a plot of ground that once grew 40 acres of green leafy peach and plum trees. It's here at the edge of town where city leaders hope to build an eco-friendly village. Community Development Director Kevin Fabino and City Manager Nicole Ziba brought me to the plot of land.
Okay, this is the site. We're on Dinuba Avenue on the south portion of Reedley.
Cool. Reedley has historically grown in a ring-like pattern of cookie-cutter tract homes, but City Manager Nicole Ziba says a plan is to change that. Her team is starting with what she calls a big idea to convert those 40 acres into an eco-friendly community called Kings River Village.
What is this dirt and weeds going to look like?
What I see is this very modern, mixed-use, colorful, vibrant community that I can feel good about knowing that when sticks went up, the developer was really concentrating on providing an environmentally responsible place for people to live.
The clusters of solar-powered homes won't have big yards, but instead will sport small strips of drought-resistant plants. Kings River Village will also have transit options, a large green space, a medical facility, and grocery stores. The community will also have a ponding basin for groundwater recharge. The amount of water to be recharged could be surprising to some.
What we found as we did a little delving into some of the studies was that the orchards would use more water than what's envisioned to be used in this particular 40-acre development.
The village is projected to use 54 acre-feet of water each year. Reedley is also working on a ponding basin with hopes to recharge 100 acre-feet of water annually. Kurt Johansson is the Bay Area-based architect that is designing Kings River Village.
Even if it rains for 40 days and 40 nights, it doesn't change the fact that every year we draw down the aquifer. So we're just using potable water inappropriately.
Johansson plans to make this community have the smallest water footprint possible.
This is quite a prototype for the valley. We think it's really the future of how to help. And so we're proposing here for these homes to have individual gray water recycling systems.
But to build, the city has hurdles it will have to jump over before Kings River Village can actually go up. Primarily a lawsuit questioning whether the community will actually help restore the aquifer underneath the city. Phil Desitoff is with the Consolidated Water District, the entity suing the town. He wants Reedley to offset how much groundwater the city pumps.
This project may use less water than most other projects you typically see, but we haven't seen anything that proves that they're actually going to use less water than the land that was there.
Desitoff isn't only questioning the development. Alex McDonald is a project manager for a group out of the University of California, Irvine, building a drought-friendly smart housing model.
I think it's good in that it provides a transition between urban and suburban life. That's something that's quite often hard to achieve and a lot of cities lack in their development.
After looking over the master plan for the proposed community, McDonald thinks the Kings River Village is a step in the right direction, but could be even friendlier to the environment.
There certainly could be a lot more done. The industry, for example, is trending towards this notion of net zero, and that is that you produce more energy than you consume. And, you know, the community doesn't quite fully develop itself there. And there's all sorts of other things in terms of materials that are locally sourced, eco-friendly, et cetera, and you can push the envelope on that.
Despite backlash from the water district over groundwater recharge, Ziba, the city manager behind the project, wants Reedley to stand out for best practices when it comes to housing and water in the state.
I think this community is not only an answer to building homes in drought times, it's an answer to the long-standing issue of poor air quality in the valley, the poor health in the valley. It really concentrates all of what I would call our misery index items and addresses all of them.
Ziba believes the environmentally conscious community is a win for the valley because change isn't always adopted so quickly in places like Reedley. She'd like to see the project break ground in 2016. With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Drought, dead and dying trees, and a lack of snow in California have left national forests in a perfect condition for large and severe wildfires. As Amy Quinton reports from Sacramento, the new mix has the U.S. Forest Service re-examining how it manages fire.
The U.S. Forest Service has historically tried to let lightning-caused fires burn in remote areas as a way to reduce forest density. The hope was to keep forests, particularly in Northern California, healthy. Chris Scow with the U.S. Forest Service Fire Aviation and Management Division says that way of managing wildfire probably won't work this year.
Due to weather conditions, you know, well beyond our control, we could see another mega fire.
Those are fires that can burn hundreds of thousands of acres severely. He says the Forest Service is attacking all fires quickly.
We're initially attacking all our fires aggressively, trying to keep them small. We're currently at our historic 98% success rate on initial attack. Our intent is to keep that going.
Jim Branham with the Sierra Nevada Conservancy says the practice of fire suppression can make severe wildfires more likely, but he's not surprised at the Forest Service decision given the dry conditions.
When you look at all the tools you have to restore these forests, we're being more limited at a time where we need to be more proactive.
The Forest Service says growing numbers of dead and dying trees in the Sierra are also adding fuel and making fire danger worse. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
And here to continue our discussion about fire season in the Sierra Nevada, we have two guests with us on the phone. I'd like to welcome to the discussion Mike Thune from Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, and also Gina Clugston from Sierra News Online. Gina, I want to start with you. This has already been an active fire season in the Central Sierra. You cover Oakhurst, Mariposa, Bass Lake, North Fork. What have residents there been facing so far this year?
Well, one good example was the Corinne Fire here in North Fork that burned 920 acres. It was a really good example for everyone about defensible space. And I know CAL FIRE is working really hard to get people educated on defensible space around their homes. We had one family who evacuated their homes. The fire burned right through their property, and it burned everything except their houses. And the reason for that was they had cleared defensible space right down to bare mineral soil within 100 feet of their homes. So when the fire came up to their fence line, it ran out of fuel, and it passed right by their house. And when they came home from being evacuated, their homes were still standing. So that it was a great example of why it's so important for people to clear the brush and the dead trees and the tall vegetation around their homes.
Have residents maybe learned something from past fires? Last year was a difficult year as well. You had the Junction Fire in Oakhurst, destroyed several homes, and also the fire in Bass Lake that burned all the way down to the shoreline. Have they learned anything, and is there a mood of trepidation right now in the community?
There is. You know, I think people are very much more aware this year of what can happen. The Courtney Fire burned 30 homes in the Bass Lake Heights area. And I think people are really paying attention this year, and hopefully they're visiting. CAL FIRE has a great website called readyforwildfire.org that shows how to clear that space and what they need to do to be prepared for this. And I see a lot more people out there working to get that defensible space cleared and really being prepared in case they need to evacuate. That those fires last year were really a heads up for people that they need to take steps before, not just wait until someone comes knocking at their door and says, there's a fire coming, you need to get out.
I want to turn now to Mike Thune from Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks, who also joins us on the phone today. Mike, in Amy Quinton's report that opened up this segment, she talked about what the national forests are facing. What's the situation in the national parks that you represent? How bad is the are conditions right now?
So this is the fourth year of an unprecedented drought, and things are changing. You know, in the past, we've done prescribed burning in areas where we've treated those fuel loads to reduce the risk of unwanted fire. And this is a year that we show if it pays dividends. We know that a community that has adapted to wildfire is a better protected community. So, as Gina was saying, when residents of a fire-prone community clear brush, trees, and other flammable materials away from their homes and other structures, it helps keep residents and firefighters safe. And for us, our firefighters really appreciate the help given to them by residents who are willing to do their part on their land to reduce the risk prior to a fire coming.
Do the national parks take a different approach to managing wildfire than, say, the national forests or CAL FIRE, as you have all these different jurisdictions? And if, and also, has the approach in any way changed this year?
So we do manage fire a little bit different than each of the other agencies because we are a different agency. We're under the U.S. Department of the Interior, so we have a slightly different mission from the U.S. Forest Service or CAL FIRE. This year, it is different. Techniques that we've used in the past, such as having more active prescribed burning program, has been reduced where we're doing more mechanical treatments, more thinning. We're looking at ways to increase our initial attacks on fires, fires that are in the front country that have any potential risk to people, visitors, park infrastructure, and other areas within the park. We're going to hit it with everything we have immediately.
You've also recently, in recent weeks, with the monsoonal moisture we had, for example, with the lightning storms last week, we saw a number of lightning-sparked blazes. How big of a concern has that been so far this year, and have you seen a number of those fires in the park?
So this year, we've been, I guess, really lucky, knock on wood, so far. At this time, we have 9 new lightning-caused fires from the storms that came through a week ago. 2 of those were actively suppressed because of where they're located in the front country. Most of them have been at high altitude elevations at above 8,000 feet and some even higher where there's such sparse fuels, jagged topography, and areas where the fire really has no place to go. So as we monitor these fires through aircraft, actually, it's a lot safer for our staff because of the difficulty of getting folks even into the locations.
The Fresno Bee had a great article over the weekend about the fire situation right now in the valley and what's going on, and specifically talking about the health of the forest. I want to turn to that side of things now. How would you characterize the health of the forest in Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks given this historic drought, and how much of that plays into the fire concern? Because it seems like even in a normal year, fires are always a concern in the mountains. How much of that forest health plays into this?
We're very fortunate on our staff in that we actually have a full-time fire ecologist. And as I've talked with him, we've looked at some of these plots that we have in our forest. And plots in areas that we've done prescribed burning in the past have less tree mortality. The vegetation has been thinned, so there's even less competition from other plants and dead and down material. The other thing is we look at our giant sequoias, which are these gorgeous, large, beautiful trees, and they have 2,500-plus years of fire history. And so we're looking at those knowing that these trees have survived droughts, and so there is some resiliency to the landscape, but at the same time we're looking at our oak trees and seeing the mortality there. The good news is the forests aren't going to completely disappear. However, when it comes to how dry it is and the environment, we're taking a more proactive approach to responding to every single fire.
I want to turn back now to Gina Klugson. We were just talking with Mike Thune from Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Gina, I saw on your website you have a great story about a family that lost their home in the Junction Fire, and now look back at that. They even took some photos there at the site of their old home. They're working to rebuild. How resilient is the community recovering from last year's devastation and moving forward now?
Well, you know, the community has been amazing at starting new organizations that will be prepared for situations like this in the future. They are rebuilding in the burn area from the Courtney Fire last year. There are new homes going up. They're taking down the old trees that were destroyed in the fire. It's just quite a hive of activity up there. People are bouncing back, and they're learning their lessons about how things happened last year and being prepared for this year.
We certainly wish everyone the best and hope for a very calm and quiet fire season this 2015 year during California's drought. We've been talking with Gina Klugson with Sierra News Online. They do a great job of covering news in the mountain communities of the Central Sierra, and also Mike Thune from Sequoia and Kings Canyon National Parks. Thanks to both of you for joining us today. This is Valley Edition. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on our program and find out why new electricity rates have some in the Valley concerned, not just about the rates, but also the structure behind those rates, what it means for you. That's all coming up. Plus, Howard Watkins talks about his photo project straight ahead on Valley Edition.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Skanska is one of the world's largest construction companies, and its U.S. chief says this country's infrastructure is in crying need of repair.
There's not enough money to go around for a lot of stuff these days, and the easy thing is to just not do the maintenance. Someday you pay the price for that.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Here and Now starts this morning at 11 on Valley Public Radio.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. A major overhaul of electricity rates is coming to California. The State Public Utilities Commission voted last Friday to switch from a four-tier billing system to a two-tier system. As a result, some low-use customers may see their bills increase, while high-use customers may see reductions. The tiers must be in place by 2019. An additional surcharge for high-use customers will be introduced in 2017. The commission delayed a proposal by utility companies for a fixed charge that consumers would pay regardless of their usage. That proposal can be considered again after 2018. The new system has caused some concern among people here in the Valley. Here to tell us more is reporter John Cox of the Bakersfield Californian, who's written about this. John, welcome.
Hi there. Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having us on.
So was this the quote-unquote worst-case scenario that some Valley folks were concerned about? And why the concern in general in this part of the state?
Well, this is actually a response to concerns that arose here in the Central Valley, which is that some of the largest users of electricity were shouldering the more than their own fair share of the cost, it was argued, because in the 2000-2001 energy crisis, state legislature became kind of spooked, decided it wanted to do more to encourage people to conserve electricity, and it set up this a tier system consisting of five different tiers. The more you use, the more you paid per unit of electricity. This is a reaction to that.
So did the proposal to change the rates based on the time of use, is that still moving forward here?
Indeed. The commission did two things, essentially, or at least it attacked this problem on two fronts. The first thing was following up on a move in 2009 by the legislature to go from five tiers to four and free up the lower tiers, which had been frozen, therefore putting more cost on the higher end users. So that was sort of one element that was done on Friday. And then the commission also moved toward what's called dynamic pricing, this time of use plan, which really gives consumers a better taste of the actual cost of providing electricity. You know, that during the day, it costs PG&E, for example, so Cal Edison, more money to provide electricity during the hottest parts. It has to bring more power plants online to cover air conditioning and such. So the commission moved forward with the what's called the smart grid plan for conservation and letting people understand better their usage. And so the time of use plan is going to go into effect. We don't have the actual details yet. That will be up to the utilities and their regulator. This is a first step toward that. There's a lot more that could be done. So that was the other element here, this time of use pricing that we'll all be facing pretty soon. Although, important to note, consumers can opt out of that time of use pricing at this time. There already a lot of businesses are on this. And so there's a lot further we can go, but people will be encouraged to, through pricing, use less electricity during the time of day when it costs more.
Certainly that is consistent with the state's greenhouse gas reduction goals and energy conservation goals. John Cox with the Bakersfield, California, with us today. John, I want to move on to a different sort of electricity, and that's on the production side and more, really, with the plant out in Tupman, the proposed Hydrogen Energy California plant. The California Energy Commission last Friday also made some news with regards to that facility. If you just saw the headline, you would think, well, that's a loss for the plant and that the commission decided to not review anything for another 6 months. But as I understand it, that's actually what the company wanted in this case.
Yeah, this is a clean coal project that has been somewhat controversial here in western Kern County. It would produce electricity. It would also produce chemicals for agriculture, such as fertilizer and potentially some transportation-related fuels. And there had been a problem with this. One of the things about this project that had been the neighbors were not all too excited about was the emissions. A lot of coal emissions would go up into the air. Now, the company was hoping to and still hopes to take the carbon dioxide and bury it underground permanently. Originally, this company had a deal with Occidental Petroleum to take that CO2 and use it for oil production. It turns out that CO2, this is soda gas, can help with loosening up the oil and make it easier to bring up to the ground and produce that oil. However, Occidental spun off its California operation. The deal that HECA, it's called, had with Occidental suddenly evaporated, and the opponents of this project said, well, you guys have not been able to secure the deal that is integral to this project. It's time to close it down. And indeed, it has been a long time. Since 2009, the Energy Commission has been reviewing this project. The company had said, listen, we're just having some problems. We need to strike a new deal. This was beyond our control. And so the company said, give us 6 months. Let's keep everything as it is, and we'll get back to you. Whereas the opponents and those who were lived right next to it, and you've got the Sierra Club, too, opposed to the emissions and use of groundwater there. It said, no, it's time to just kill this project altogether. In that sense, this six-month hiatus is a victory for the company that now has some breathing room, now can try to either restart talks with the Oxy spinoff called California Resources Corporation, or it can find somewhere else. Of course, if it finds another user for this CO2 or somewhere to permanently sequester this carbon, then it's going to take even longer. So in one sense, the company has a reprieve, but it's certainly no guarantee that this project is eventually going to be able to overcome the challenges ahead.
It's certainly a controversial one. We'll continue to follow that and read about it in the Bakersfield Californian. John Cox with the Californian joining us today. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Some artists are truly prolific. Composer Franz Josef Haydn wrote over 100 symphonies. Science fiction writer Isaac Asimov wrote 450 books, over 450 books, in fact. Our next guest is nowhere near as famous as those two men, but he is just as prolific, if not more so. He has taken over 300,000 photographs of life in Fresno since 1973. He's retired Fresno attorney Howard Watkins. Some of his best work is part of a new exhibit, his first ever solo show. It's at Fresno State's Henry Madden Library Ellipse Gallery now through August 14th with 48 photos on display. Howard joins us today. Howard, welcome.
Thank you.
Did you ever think you were going to take 300,000 photographs when you started out this project?
Never. Not even close.
Why did you begin, and what was your rationale?
Well, originally it was just a hobby. I started taking photographs in junior high and high school and college. And when we moved to Fresno in 73, travel and family photos. But I was active in the Bar Association, started doing bar luncheons and dinner programs. And I'm active in community groups, and I take a photo here and there. And at some point, people were telling me, you know, you got a historic record here. And very influenced by Pop LaValle and what his great-granddaughter Elizabeth LaValle has done with his collection of photos. And, yes, yeah, so my camera went wherever I went. I had a Canon for many years. Now it's a Nikon. So I have good camera equipment. I'm not a professional. I'm an amateur photographer. But 300,000 photos, you tend to develop some very decent photography skills.
So what are your favorites that you look back at that are in the gallery, I imagine?
Well, my favorite one is one that wasn't in Fresno. It was down in L.A. I have a picture of Muhammad Ali in 1967. He's at an anti-war rally and signing autographs. But historic, probably the most historic photo is one of four women, the presiding judge of the Superior Court, Hillary Chittick, district attorney then Elizabeth Egan, Sheriff Margaret Mims, and chief probation officer Linda Pinner. And I got the four of them together, even though they have a very busy schedule. And that represents the first time four women held those court-related positions in the history of California. And that grouping would not have happened if I hadn't contacted them and they accommodated me.
It also has to be interesting for you to go to these events and be the man behind the camera. Do you go to specific things just to take photographs, or is it just, I'm going to be at this luncheon, I'll bring my camera with me?
It's both. And over the last probably 10, 15 years, I've made a point that if something's historic, I will go to it. So, for example, when they had the groundbreaking of the high-speed rail downtown, I made a point to be there and took a lot of photos. Groundbreakings only happen once. When they dedicated the Woodward Park Library, I was there for the ribbon cutting. And I also tend to specialize now in large group photos. Amongst the photos on display is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom celebrated their local chapter 25th anniversary back in the early 90s at the Hacienda Ballroom, which no longer exists. And I said, let's do a group photo. So there's 100-plus people in that. Same thing, I spoke to the Rotary Club downtown, which is one of the largest in the state and country, and I set it up so afterwards we do a group photo of about 200 members.
So what have you learned over the years in your time as a photographer and also working with people in something like this?
There's a lot of history. And up until the proliferation of smartphones, if I was not at an event, even an awards luncheon, there was no photographs taken. That just blew me away that they spend money on these major events. Two other examples. When the Fresno State women's softball team won the national championship and later when the men's won the baseball championship, they had their big gung-ho rallies at Bulldog Diamond and Biden Field. And the university wasn't going to do a team photo. And I asked the coach, could we do a team photo? And said, yes. So there's team photos at the home celebration because I asked for it.
Now, this exhibit that's at the Henry Madden Library right now through August 14th is some of your best work. 48 photos on display, some other digital things as well in that exhibit. But I want to talk now about the project and your relationship with the library. First of all, 300,000 photographs, Howard. How do you even store and catalog, manage that size of a collection?
It takes a lot of time, and as has been pointed out to me, it's more of an obsession than a hobby. Because when you take 10 or 15,000 photos a year on your own time and your own dime, because I was working as a full-time attorney, you really got to spend a lot of time then editing the photos, et cetera. But everything's digital. The community responded when I started the project to raise the donate funds through the Fresno Regional Foundation. This project is a partnership of the Madden Library, the Regional Foundation, and me. To get all my negatives scanned, I had over 100,000 negatives, but until they're digitized, you can't really do much with it. So that was done, but now I'm in the process of having to raise $200,000 as an endowment for the cost of putting the photos online through the library. It could be like 10 terabytes worth of photos. It's a lot of photos, which would cover 1973 to 2003. And then to maintain it, because they have to refresh it. You don't just upload it and it's there forever. You got to refresh it, otherwise it deteriorates. So I'm hoping people will donate to the Fresno Regional Foundation. You can do it online. It's Fresno Reg, R-E-G, foundation.org, and donate when you're online to the Howard K. Watkins Photographic Archive Fund. And that fund is used to pay for the expenses of the project. I don't get any income to me. And one of the keys to this project is I'm giving up my financial interest in it. This is intended to be an online database free to the public, where if they find a photo they want, they can download it and use it for personal, non-commercial use.
I understand you're also – you have a new title as well. Oh. You're Fresno Photographer Laureate, Photo Laureate?
Photo Laureate. The Board of Supervisors in 2010 designated me the county's Photo Laureate. It's an honorary title. I'm very honored by that. And the city council and mayor last month adopted a similar resolution. Paul Capiolio led the effort. And I'm very honored by that. They both properly recognized Poplar Valley as the first, but I'm his successor, and I'm very honored by that.
When you go to non-public events, do you approach them the same way, maybe family events or parties? Do you also always have your camera with you?
I do. As one quick story, my daughter went to Roosevelt High, and she was in the yearbook staff one year, and the instructor said, okay, I want all of you to bring in your baby pictures because we want to put one in the yearbook. And he turned to my daughter, Robin, and said, Robin, I know your dad. You have no excuses.
Great story indeed. Howard Watkins, a retired Fresno attorney, is with us today talking about his side project, his hobby, and his truly love, his photo archive, 300,000 photos of life in Fresno over the years since 1973. Some of his best work is on exhibit at the Madden Library. It's taken this long to have an exhibit. Is this ever something you thought about before?
It's a lot of work, and I was really focused on getting photos indexed and raising the funds. But it seemed like it was a good time, and the library was available, and letting more people know about the breadth of my work. The people in the legal community know I take pictures there, and the faith community there, and political community there, and community organizations. But one of the things with these photo boards and the 48 photos, it shows the breadth. I mean, I go from Audra McDonald, the Bluesteins, and Margaret Hudson to the sports photos and historic parades, honoring our veterans, faith communities. So it's a very broad collection. There's, besides the 48, there's about 400 more photos on display there on photo boards by subject matter. And then there's another 1,000 on a slideshow on the computer monitor.
Anywhere along the way, did you ever say, gosh, you know, I don't know if I really want to keep doing this, or am I going to do this for forever? Was there ever a point when you thought maybe, I don't know?
There have been times that I think I bit more than I can chew, especially at 2 in the morning, and I'm trying to get it done and get to bed. My wife has been extraordinarily patient and supportive, but it takes far more time than I ever thought.
Now that you're retired, you're taking more photos, I take it.
Well, that's one of the problems. I retired from active warrioring in 07 to index my photos. So I had all this free time. And if people don't think there's stuff happening in Fresno-Clovis area, you're just not paying attention. I could do 10 events a day without trying. And anyway, I took another 150,000 photos. That's how I got to 300,000 photos. And so I have a lot of photos to index. I've indexed 11,000. I figured I got somewhere over 50 to 60,000 I need to index.
We're talking with Fresno photographer, retired attorney Howard Watkins. He has taken over 300,000 photographs of life in Fresno since 1973. His work is in the special collections of the Henry Madden Library, and there is a new exhibit showcasing some of his finest work. It's his first ever solo show at the Henry Madden Library's Ellipse Gallery, now through August 14th.
And the library is open Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's free. It's a step back in history. Fair number of people probably see themselves in one or more of the photos.
We'll look forward to that. Indeed, again, Howard Watkins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and happy birthday.
This is Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. In tiny Del Rey sits one of the nation's most acclaimed organic farms. The Masumoto family has been farming the land there for generations, and now their heirloom peaches are sought after by some of the country's top chefs. But the Masumoto farm is also in transition, a transition of generations. As David Masumoto begins the process of handing over control of the operation to his daughter, Nikiko. The story is the subject of a new documentary called Changing Seasons. There's a special limited screening of the film at the family's farm this Saturday. Nikiko Masumoto joins us now on Valley Edition. Nikiko, welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
When the filmmakers behind this new documentary first approached you, what was your family's reaction?
Oh my gosh, I think we were all in shock. The Stephen Gong, who's the executive director of the Center for Asian American Media, which is the producing nonprofit, they approached us wanting to just explore filming something. And we had a really great relationship with Stephen. And so a crew, small, very small crew, came down and did just one day of shooting. And we thought it went super well. And we thought originally it was just going to be a short documentary, just a couple minutes long. But then they kept coming back and back and back. And they ended up following us for an entire season. And so we were honored and shocked. And it was also a really fascinating experience being involved with a film because it's a completely new medium for us. You know, my dad writes, I've written a little bit, and we've done storytelling and public speaking, but never film. So the adventure of filming was really interesting.
Did you have an idea about what the filmmakers wanted to do when you started out? Did they have an idea?
The film director, Jim Choi, we had lots of conversations about it, and his style of filming documentary was really rooted in letting the story unfold as he kind of embedded in our lives and observed us. And that was really interesting because we, as a family of writers and performers, tend to want to write out the narrative. And so, I mean, halfway through, we really had a deep understanding of how much trust you really have to have with a film because they're capturing these really intimate lives. And ultimately, we were giving our trust to the director, Jim Choi, and the editor, Chihiro Wimbush, to represent us. And that is a really magical exchange.
How difficult was it to go about your normal activities on the farm or around the dinner table, whatever it may be, with a camera crew around next to you, standing behind you, and all the other things that go along with that.
Yeah, when they first started coming, I had trouble with it. It was I kept on kind of trying to hide from the camera because it's kind of awkward. You're supposed to act like they're not there, but there's this big camera that you know is recording every move, and you know you have a microphone on you, so every sound is recorded. But as the year progressed, really the director, the sound tech, the editor, they really became our friends. And so it became much easier and easier to really be as organic as possible.
As organic as possible, indeed. Our guest today is Nikiko Matsumoto. She and her family are the subject of a new film called Changing Season on the Matsumoto family farm. It is premiering in a local form in a screening at the Matsumoto farm on Saturday. This is an RSVP event. We'll give out details on that in a moment. Right now, though, I want to play a clip from the film. And this one deals with one of the central themes of this film, and that's literally the changing seasons and focusing on your dad and his involvement with the farm. Let's listen to this now.
I don't think you choose to be a farmer, and I think it's partly because if you try to make it as a rational decision, it doesn't make sense. You know, you put in hours and hours of your labor, uncertain about the economic return on it. It's physical. It breaks down your body, and as I'm getting older, I'm very aware of that.
Nikiko, when you see that clip and you see your dad and talking about the toll that it's taken on him, not only physically, but also the stress and strain of being in charge of the farm and all of those things, what do you feel inside when you see that?
I feel a really deep inhale, because one of the things that I've learned coming back to the farm is not only is this transition about me kind of ascending and learning and growing and reaching for the vision of my future on the farm, but it's also about witnessing and being intimately involved with my parents aging. And I think that's a side of family farming that we tend not to talk about. We tend to focus on the next generation, which as a next generation, I'm grateful for because, gosh, I have a lot to learn. But the changing season is also about my dad and my mom, but particularly my dad, because he's the one I farm next to every day. It's about him reflecting on his life. And this transition is part of it is about letting go.
We have another clip from the film now. This one is more focused on you, Nikiko. Let's hear your clip from the film again, Changing Season on the Matsumoto family farm.
My decision to come back to the Central Valley and live being queer, being mixed race, being progressive, I came home with no illusion that it would be easy. I have found a home for myself here, both on the farm as a peaceful place for me to be free with the trees as my best friends and my family, who are amazing human beings. The big picture is resilience, right? The big picture is to continue to do this, to save the family farm for another generation, to keep feeding people.
Go Beach!
That's this renewal that I get from the community of people we have gotten to share our harvests with.
So tell us a little more about what you were just talking about there, Nikiko, as your decision to come back to the valley, come back to the farm. Your dad had to make that same decision as well. How do you feel you can gain some insights from what he went through, but also it's different for you as well?
Yeah, my dad and I, our trajectories are really fascinating because they're very similar. We both went to UC Berkeley. We both had no intentions of coming back to the farm, and we both ended up right back where we grew up. And so one of the ironies of that story is, like, gosh, if someone had told me when I was a 17-year-old and I left that I would be following in my dad's footsteps, literally, I would have laughed in their faces. And here I am. And not only am I back in the physical valley and the physical home, but My dad is both my boss, my teacher, my mentor, my friend, my coworker. And so part of our dynamic is really captured in this film, which is of all of these shifting roles. I'm never just an employee. I'm always also a daughter. And part of learning to farm, part of working alongside him, has been negotiating all of those similarities and all of those differences.
How do you learn to do that? Is it just by trial and error? Do you have others you lean upon? The one person who has the experience doing that is your dad.
My dad.
Because there was another transition before this one.
Right. My dad came back and learned to farm with my Jichon, my grandfather, his father. And we've talked a lot about those double transitions. And so much of it, we end up talking about our personalities. My Jichon was a very quiet man. And so a lot of the lessons that my dad learned were in these really subtle silences, really, on the farm. And my dad and I, in contrast, are both very verbal people. And so we end up talking a lot. And so through the years, the first year coming back was challenging. We're both fairly strong personalities. And so I think in an interesting way, I'm so glad you asked that question. It's been a practice for me to cultivate the silence, because my dad and I talk so much that in a way I've had to intentionally make room for silence and reflection, that maybe that was what my dad had with my Jichon, automatically because of my Jichon style and who he was as a person.
That's fascinating. Full circle in a different way.
Yeah.
Indeed. And Nikiko Masumoto is our guest today, talking about the new film produced on the farm, telling the story of change in generations at one of the nation's foremost organic farms, known for their peaches worldwide, also their raisins and more. Nikiko talking about this film that is premiering, or at least its Valley premiere, Saturday at the farm. It's an RSVP event. We'll give out that information in a moment. Before we do that, when the film was finished, you all sat down, I imagine, in some way to watch this. Did you watch it alone? Did you watch it as a family? What was that like?
The director and editor, Jim and Shihiro, and one of the producers, Don, from the Center for Asian American Media, they came down to the farm and they brought a television screen and brought the latest version of the film. And we sat in our living room, my mom, dad, brother, and I, and we watched this film. And I don't think I've ever had such an intense experience with a film. Watching was like this out-of-body experience, because you never get to see your life the way you see it on film, because you're always in your body. You're always in your life. And, I mean, we all wept. We wept. We laughed. And afterwards, when it was done, there was just this silence that was so full of tenderness. I mean, Jim and Shihiro, they really listened to our lives, and they really made choices in the filming and editing that showcased who we were, and not just the happy side of our family, but also some of the struggles and some of the moments of unexpected tenderness and emotion.
You mentioned some of those unexpected moments. Your dad went through a major situation during the production of this film. Would you care to talk about that?
Yeah. I mean, who would have known at the beginning of the filming that later my dad would go through a triple bypass heart surgery? And that just happened to be during the window that we were filming. And there are moments in his recovery that were completely unexpected, conversations that were captured in this film that when I still watch it, I still cry, because there are these moments of uncertainty between a father and daughter where health and mortality are really present in the room. And what is fascinating listening back to those moments of exchange was I realized in watching the film that while I was processing his life and really bracing for the future, he was still processing the loss of his father. And so there really was an intergenerational experience of his health in the room, even though my Jichon, my grandfather, has passed away. His story was still very much alive in those moments.
What's it like to see other people watch the film and see their reactions and what they get out of it?
It's the most interesting type of nerve-wracking I've ever experienced in my life, because it's such an intimate window into our lives. And I get nervous every time, even though I don't have to do anything. You know, somebody just presses play. And every time we've shown the film, we've gotten to have a talk-back session, a question and answer period. And I have been really floored by the openness of the audiences. People have come up to us and asked these really beautiful questions along all of these themes that are present in the film. Farming and agriculture, the Central Valley as a place for a next generation to take root, death and transition over generations, gender, queerness. The film captures a story about me and my experience of being queer in the Central Valley. And so people have come up to me saying, "You're so brave." And I just am so honored. I don't always feel brave in my everyday life, but these small exchanges help remind me that no, that there is something bold and beautiful about who I am and what I'm trying to do, what we're trying to do as a family on our farm.
Nikiko, I understand that in addition to this screening that's coming up in just a few days at your farm in Del Rey, there's also going to be in about a year, a little less than a year, a national broadcast of the film.
Yeah, we're really grateful, really honored. PBS has scheduled our film to air nationally in May 2016. I think the details are still being worked out, but we are just honored to have that kind of reception.
So for people who are interested in seeing the film now, what can they do with the event that's coming up on Saturday, and what are the particulars?
Yeah, we are hosting a outdoor farm screening of the film on our farm. There's just a few spots left that we're keeping for Valley Public Radio listeners. And so you'll have to go to our webpage, www.masumoto.com. And there's a link on our homepage to the registration website where you'll just need to register your name and email so we can email you directions and details. Yeah.
And are there any other screenings or film festivals in the works?
The film has been submitted to a couple different film festivals, one in Hawaii, one in Vancouver, one in San Diego. We're still waiting with our fingers crossed to see if the film gets into those festivals. But it's also scheduled to screen in Houston. An Asian American group there is hosting a screening. And then it's also been scheduled to be a part of a food celebration at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C. in October.
Congratulations. This sounds like a great, great occasion indeed. And for the next year, we would look forward to all those events that are coming up. The film is called Changing Season on the Masumoto Family Farm. It tells the story of changing generations on one of the valley's premier, one of the nation's premier organic farms, the Masumoto family and their peach farm in Del Rey. Nikiko Masumoto joins us today, one of the subjects of the film. Nikiko, best of luck to you as this film continues to roll out, and congratulations on being part of a successful project like this.
Oh my gosh, thanks so much, Joe.
Well, that's all for today's Valley Edition. We hope you enjoyed our program. As always, you can find it online on our website. We'll have this show posted in just a few moments on the website at kvpr.org. You can find past shows as well in our audio archive. Again, Valley Edition online at the all-new kvpr.org. Check out the new website. We hope you like the new design. You can also let us know what you think when you're there. You can send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet at kvpr and at Valley Edition are our Twitter handles. Find us on Facebook as well. Valley Public Radio is our handle on Facebook. For our entire staff here at Valley Public Radio, audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, and reporters Jeffrey Hess and Deanna Aguilera, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition, a production of Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.